Some unexpected good news today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. When this Nigerian writer heard that dozens of kidnapped girls were about to be freed, she didn't believe it.
It sounded too far-fetched to be true. 2 hours later, I got another message saying the girls had actually been brought into the community by Boko Haram militants who dropped them off and left.
Also, why French census forms don't have boxes to collect data on race.
So many boxes and you have to check what is your background. And basically, it was unsettling for me. It's hard to be like, okay, if I take that, I will only be that because I'm so much more than that.
Plus, a daring reporter explores a massive crack that split a highway in Kenya.
I have decided to follow this massive crack as it goes further inland.
That and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. We want to start with some good news out of Nigeria. We've been following the story of 110 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants in Nigeria last month. Today, more than half of them were released and returned to their hometown of Dapchi. Nigerian officials say it's the result of the government's back-channel efforts with Boko Haram. Adobe Tricia Nwambani is a writer based in Abuja who's been following this case closely. Adobe, tell us what happened this morning. What do we know about why some of the schoolgirls were released?
The government hasn't made any information available beyond the fact that the girls were released and there was no ransom paid. That's as much as we know. It was sudden. No one expected it. But as early as 7 a.m., I got reports from Dapchi saying that they'd been told that their girls were on the way, that Boko Haram was bringing them. Obviously, I thought it was, too far-fetched to be true. 2 hours later, I got another message saying the girls had actually been brought into the community by Boko Haram militants who dropped them off and left. So there must have been some sort of arrangement between the Nigerian government and the militants that they will be given safe passage. Well, the government has said as much, that there was some sort of ceasefire agreement between the time it took them to bring the girls and we don't know when. But they've said no ransom was paid, the girls were freed, and we don't know what Boko Haram got in return.
Now, as I understand it, this happened, as you said, earlier this morning. Do we know how many girls were released and what is the status of the others who were not released?
The girls were returned in a number of trucks. The Nigerian government has confirmed that 101 girls were freed. I spoke with people in Dapchi, and the information coming from the girls is that 5 of their classmates died. 3 of them on the way to the Sambisa Forest hideout of Boko Haram after they were kidnapped. 3 of them fell out of the trucks and into the river. And then 2 others died in the forest from different illnesses. There's a 6th girl who refused to convert to Islam, and they said they will hold her until she converted, and she refused. So these are the 6 girls we know of who haven't returned.
A lot of people are doubting whether the Nigerian government paid a ransom or not. What's your sense of that?
You know, because there was so much secrecy about the ransom paid for the first 2 batches of Chibok girls released, the government didn't tell anyone. It wasn't officially declared. And obviously, those of us who've been talking to insiders knew that money was paid, but it was never mentioned by the government. At some point, they said they had exchanged 5 Boko Haram commanders. But some of us knew, even before it was publicized, that some money had been exchanged as well. So when the news eventually broke, of course, people were put off. There were the debates about, you know, whether it was worth it, all that money. So now that the government is saying we paid nothing, nobody's believing them. I don't think there's anything the government will say now that will make people believe that there was no transfer of money or that Boko Haram didn't get something significant in return.
In the case of the ransom that was discovered that was paid for the release of some of the Chibok girls, isn't there concern that that ransom simply goes to finance other abductions?
Exactly. You know, people questioned the reasoning behind it, the sense behind it. But at the same time, you know, the government was obviously desperate and they felt the publicity coup was worth it. And we don't know anyway the full details of the agreements they had with Boko Haram when they released that money. We don't know that yet. So it's possible they were giving some concrete assurances about a new direction the conflict will take. And bearing in mind that the government is still negotiating with Boko Haram. So we don't really know everything going on. It's all so hazy because nobody, of course, is being open.
What's the condition of the girls who were released?
One of the parents described them as appearing panicked when they were first dropped off by Boko Haram militants. Initially, they were not able to respond to questions, but gradually, of course, they thawed, reunited with their families. There was a lot of hugging. There was a lot of screaming and, you know, excitement. But they're in good health. They said they were well fed. They were well taken care of. You know, typical stories. We've been hearing that from captives of Boko Haram. These high profile kidnappings, they all come out saying, we were well fed. We were well taken care of. They didn't harm us in any way. So these girls are saying the same thing.
I understand, oddly, that some of the parents of the Chibok girls were in Dapchi this morning when the girls who were kidnapped from Dapchi were released. What was going on there?
That's just the most ironic thing. It's just one of those amazing coincidences. The Chibok parents had scheduled to go to Dapchi on a condolence visit. The Dapchi kidnappings happened just 4 weeks ago. So the Chibok parents were just able to gather themselves together and arrange this trip. It was sponsored by the Muritella Mohammed Foundation here in Nigeria that has been supporting the Chibok parents. So they managed to get themselves together and organize this trip a month after. They had also tried to time it with the 1 month anniversary of the Dapchi kidnappings. And they had told me just before they left, so they were hoping to encourage the Dapchi parents, tell them be patient, tell them when some of our daughters were kidnapped, some parents didn't eat for months, some parents wept for months, and we've lost 18 parents. 18 parents have died from all sorts of sicknesses related to the stress they faced when the daughters were kidnapped. So they said, we want to share experiences with them. And I had spoken with Dapchi as well, and the parents in Dapchi were expecting them and said, we hope that they will teach us how to handle the advocacy, how to deal with the local government, the state government, and even on the international level, how to keep our matter in the public eye. You know, each group had expectations. So they arrived at about 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, couldn't meet with the Dapchi parents that late, and they scheduled to meet with them Wednesday morning. Lo and behold, they wake up at 7 a.m. only to find that the entire town is running around and everybody's excited and shouting. And they say, what's happened? And they tell that our girls are on their way home. So the visit obviously takes on a completely different shade. Like one of the mothers, the women leader of the Chibok parents said to me, our visit has changed. You know, she said it's become something else. Of course, for them, it was joyful watching the girls being reunited with their families. But one of them said she wept and wept and wept watching other parents being reunited with their daughters after 1 month of being in captivity, while her daughter has been away for almost 4 years and she has no idea of the fate of her daughter. So it was a bittersweet experience for them. One of the parents also admitted to me that she was relieved to know that the Dapchi girls had been returned so that the focus can once again return to their daughters and there is no distraction from the fact that these girls have been missing for almost 4 years.
Do you think the successful return of the Dapchi girls will change anything in terms of the government's strategy for getting other girls who've been kidnapped back?
There have been thousands of girls kidnapped since the insurgency started, but the only girls that are being discussed publicly and are being negotiated for are the Chibok girls and, of course, subsequently the Dapchi girls. So it's the high-profile kidnappings that make it into the news and then the government starts negotiating. What we've been made to understand is that there are two separate factions of Boko Haram that have the Chibok girls and the separate faction had the Dapchi girls. So we don't know what conversations are happening with these separate factions. I know that as of December, there were still conversations going on with Boko Haram about the return of the Chibok girls, and the government still says publicly, we're still negotiating their release. But I think the government must have been working on this because they sounded pretty confident. When President Buhari visited there last week, he told them, we'll certainly bring your girls back. So there was a level of confidence and they have not rescued them. They have negotiated their release. We don't know the terms of that release. We hope it's not throwing money at Boko Haram. Whatever it is, we hope it was worth it.
Adobe Trisha Nombani is a writer based in Abuja. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you, Carol.
Our next story takes us to France. Last fall, President Emmanuel Macron announced a program to try to cut high unemployment among young people in heavily immigrant neighborhoods. He said the idea would be to pay bonuses to companies that hire people from designated areas.
On aide les personnes et on les aide pour être mobiles, pour aller réussir dans leur quartier ou ailleurs, mais accéder à un emploi stable.
Macron said this would help people access staple jobs and succeed, whether in their neighborhoods or outside of them. The fact that the program is structured around neighborhoods is a very French approach to what we think of as race-based affirmative action here in the U.S. And as Emma Jacobs reports, it's also an attempt to address a big taboo in the world of French statistics.
Awa Tamara is 26. She works in corporate recruiting. And her last job involved narrowing down lists of candidates for clients. Typical stuff. But she recalls one time when a client openly rejected applicants based on their ethnic background.
Where the manager said, I don't want black or big people. We were hurt
Tamara was born and raised in France. Her parents are from Senegal.
I really had tears that were going up because when it's done to people of color, it's like it's done to you. And you think that people don't like you to the point they don't want you to have a job that you deserve.
Now, the fact that discrimination goes on in France did not shock her. It was hearing it stated so explicitly.
It's really hard to put a finger on racism because it's really subtil.
Subtle. Nicolas Abdelaziz's job is to make discrimination more visible. Abdelaziz has an app on his phone that allows him to receive calls for about a dozen different numbers.
Qui nous permettent d'avoir sur un même téléphone plusieurs numéros.
He sends all the calls to voicemail.
Avec un répondeur, généralement, il laisse un message.
Because each of the numbers belongs to a fictitious candidate for a job, for an apartment, whatever subject Abdelaziz is looking into. All he really wants to see is the number of callbacks each candidate gets. Abdelaziz works for one of France's most well-known anti-racism organizations, SOS Racisme. And he uses a method of measuring discrimination the French call...
Le testing.
Le testing. So to look at hiring, for example, Abdelaziz sends out resumes.
Donc les deux sont identiques. Seule différence, c'est la consonance.
Two identical resumes, he says. The only difference is the person's name and what it suggests about their origin. For instance, a North or West African name versus an old French surname. If they get called back at different rates.
C'est discriminatoire, puisqu'en fait, à valeur égale et à compétence égale, il y a une différence de traitement qui ne peut être motivée que par l'origine.
Given the candidates have the same qualifications, the only reason can be their background, he says. Testing has been the primary tool in France for decades to document racial disparities.
This is a very powerful tool to prove the existence of discrimination. The problem is that it doesn't go further than that.
Demographer Patrick Simon is one of a few French researchers who say to understand the bigger impacts of discrimination, the country needs to reconsider restrictions on the collection of ethnic statistics.
The notion of ethnicity, which I say in English, is not easy to translate in French.
Simon explains that in the past 50 years or so, France has taken the approach of de-emphasizing racial categories. Post-World War II, post-decolonization, a lot of people don't want the government to have lists of people and their origins or religion. Researchers like Simon can use proxies, like place or birth of your parents, but he argues collecting comprehensive statistics would make for more effective anti-discrimination policies.
I don't know, but...
The thing is, as Awa Timera will attest, this taboo is deeply embedded in French culture. She has worked in the UK and describes the first time she had to fill out a detailed form that asked her to identify her race.
You have so many boxes and you have to check what is your background. And basically, it was unsettling for me because you have a box that says African. And I was started to wonder, basically, my parents, they were born in Africa, but I was born in France, so should I say that I'm black African or I don't know. It's really weird. It's hard to be like, okay, if I take that, I will only be that because I'm so much more than that.
Tamara would like to see more opportunities for people with immigrant backgrounds, but she is conflicted about what steps France should take to get there. For the World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
Coming up a bit later on the show, residents of Kenya's Rift Valley find themselves on very shaky ground. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Earlier this week, we discussed the life and tragic death of Marielle Franco. Many in Brazil have been mourning Franco, a Rio de Janeiro city council member who was gunned down last Wednesday. One of her best friends and closest colleagues is David Miranda. David, first, I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I know you have so much in common with Marielle Franco. You two are a Rio city council member. You both grew up in the favelas. You're in the same left-wing party, and you're both gay. You say on your website that these traits really make it unbelievable that you would wind up on the city council, and yet there you and Franco were, seated next to each other. Explain how unusual this is in Brazil and why it matters.
Well, just the beginning, like, it's so unusual for people actually to vote for leftist party, like socialists, like we are. And people see human rights here like something really bad, that we only defend criminals. So their expression to vote for two people that comes from the favela, they are black and LGBT, is a expression, like a huge change, a shift on the way that people are thinking and voting and democracy now. For 10 years, we didn't have a black woman elected as a council in a city of Rio de Janeiro. So you see the importance of like Marielle and me over there. It's huge.
What were some of the things you and Franco were working on together?
Well, we work on the LGBT cases. We got denounces about the police on the favelas. Everybody who comes to look for us, we will help them. Like, we just think to be a council is to be a tool for the city. So anybody who wants to use this tool just have to come and find us and talk to us, and we will help any way they need.
What were some of the LGBT issues you worked on?
Well, I passed a law for the right to the trans people use the name they choose. There's many laws that I wanted to pass, like create a center for LGBTs in the city. She tried to pass a law for create the lesbian day. It didn't pass. The house is so conservative. Yeah, so many laws like that.
Shortly before Franco's death, she was made rapporteur for a commission monitoring the militarization of security in Rio. And the military has long intervened in Rio's favelas. And recently, President Michel Temer announced a federal takeover of Rio's security. What does that mean for someone living in one of these favelas?
Well, the military, they stop people. They are taking pictures of the people with their documents. Search, even kids, bags going to school. People have fear because they wear a mask, so they don't actually see who they're talking to. And most of the times, those are 18 years old boys. And if there's any kind of shooting, they're not prepared to engage in a civil society. They are trained to go to war. So it's really complicated for people who lives there because they abuse power. Temer tried to pass last year a decree saying that the military only going to be judged by the military, not by any tribunal or judge outside the military. So this is giving like the military total force to kill, to abuse human rights, and to do anything they want without even getting a price to go to jail or detention or anything.
In the days following Franco's death, many activists are saying that Brazil needs to keep her struggles alive. But on the city council, is it you? I mean, are you the one to carry on her work?
Yes, I have to carry her work. I have colleagues who's going to carry her work as well. Of course, I have to work more because I'm the black, I'm the LGBT, I'm the guy from the favela in there. But everybody has much responsibility that I have on all this.
Are you concerned for your own safety?
Yes, I am concerned by my safety. I've been feeling a little paranoid on the core. The other day I was going to the Câmara.
And when you say Câmara, you mean the city council?
Yes, it's the city council. A car stopped next to my car. I kind of frozen. I'm having like a little bit shakings in my body. I'm experiencing like a post-traumatic experience because what happened to her, it's a political murder. So a political kill, it's sending a message, and we haven't got the killer.
Are you taking precautions of your own?
Yes, yes. Using cameras, doing as much as possible to make me safe, limiting the events that I'm doing. But this is the thing, like I cannot be limit myself for the longest time. I'm doing that now, but I have to keep fighting because that's what she would scream at me, like if I don't fight, who's going to fight for everybody who vote for us?
Looking at Brazilian politics nationally, the conservative administration of Michel Temer has been described as high in testosterone and low in pigment. Temer's cabinet is almost entirely white, and it's the first one in more than three decades that's 100% male. General elections are coming up in October, and Are you hoping to see some change in the executive branch?
Yeah, I think Brazil has passed now for a big blow in democracy. And with the impeachment of Dilma and Temer getting there, and all the accusations about him being corrupted, he is corrupt, I dare to say, because all the things, all the tapes that he got in. And so I think this election will change a lot in the perspective of the future of the country. And with the Marielle's, Franco's death, I think this will change in coloring as well, the Congress that we have and maybe the president that we have as well.
I know you're married to a well-known American journalist, Glenn Greenwald, and he had an article in The Independent recently about Marielle Franco in which he said her loss was devastating for your family. What did she mean to your children?
It was like an aunt for my children, was how I explained a lesbian couple to them. Like, we are two men, but they're like, she has a partner, Monica. They used to come on weekends to our home, and the kids got to know them, like to play with them, like to stay with them. And we become like part of each other. Like, it was really good to have her around and to have her joy. And like, it's a great, great, great loss for me and for my family.
David Miranda is a member of the City Council of Rio de Janeiro. He was a close friend and colleague of Marielle Franco, who was murdered last week. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
I'm Carol Hills. Women who work in the field for international aid organizations face many dangers, including sexual harassment by coworkers.
This staff started telling me, you know, things inappropriate, even touch me. And I told him, you know, I don't think I like what you're doing.
That story's ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. This week, we're looking at the hidden dangers for women working in the international humanitarian aid sector as part of our Across Women's Lives project. I'll let Marco Werman take it from here.
I've got Amy Costello back with me again. She's the Nonprofit Quarterly Senior Correspondent and Investigations Editor. Amy, what are you going to tell us about today?
Marco, we're going to talk about aid workers who make up a growing part of the industry, people of color from developing nations. They're hired locally in their own countries, and those staff are often referred to as national staff. And increasingly, these national staff are deployed to other nations, too. So you might find, say, a Zimbabwean delivering aid in Haiti or South Sudan, or someone from Ecuador working in Honduras. And when these staff begin to travel like that, they face risks. Like this aid worker from the Eastern Horn of Africa region that I talked to.
When I left my country and started moving, you know, I felt like I was a lot more exposed to sexual harassment, and I often ask myself why.
So, Amy, who is this? Tell us her story.
Well, this is a veteran aid worker, and she agreed to speak to me if we would protect her identity. She's still working in the sector, and so I'm going to call her Linda. And her experience speaks to some of the unique challenges faced by many aid workers of color from developing nations. Keep in mind that this group makes up the majority of aid workers working across the globe. And when Linda is deployed to other countries, she is often working with male colleagues who also come from other parts of the world. And so each man she's working with likely has very different opinions about how women should be treated in the workplace. And here's Linda's story about how she has to navigate that.
As a South African woman, you know, you struggle with a lot of things. Yes, you're coming from a highly patriarchal setting and you're trying to, you know, overcome that. We are also most time deployed in settings which is deeply patriarchal, where men do not respect women.
In the decade that Linda has worked in humanitarian aid, she says she's been sexually harassed or assaulted in every nation she's traveled to, except for one. And a lot of that harassment happened in guest houses. Aid workers like Linda often stay in these guest houses or team houses when on assignment, which means Linda frequently sleeps under the same roof with colleagues she has never met.
I must say, sharing guest houses with people you don't know their background, it's very, very challenging for female staff and provides avenues where female workers, female humanitarian aid workers, are easily exposed to sexual harassment.
For instance, Linda was working in what was considered a hardship post in East Africa for a well-known international aid group. Every few weeks, she'd get a couple of days R&R in the capital city at the organization's guest house. Linda says one time she went there and found the place empty. And then a male colleague arrived, whom she had never met.
So I greeted, we had conversation. So this staff started telling me, you know, things inappropriate, how he liked me, even touched me. And I told him, you know, I don't think I like what you're doing. Cannot just touch someone like that or tell someone something inappropriate. So anyway, stop that. We shifted to other conversation. But what shocked me is that when I went to my room, I discovered that I could not lock the room while I'm sleeping. If I can remember, that was the longest night I ever had because I was so scared. I was imagining, what if this guy walks into my room and rapes me?
He didn't. The guy left the next morning on another assignment. But Linda says if she had been raped that night, she doesn't think anyone would have believed her. And she doubts that she would get the same kind of support that a Western colleague would receive.
I think in general terms, yes, black women who report the case are not handled in the same way as a white woman.
She gives an example of how she and some African colleagues responded after one of their American colleagues was sexually assaulted and subsequently evacuated by helicopter, or chopper, as Linda calls it.
The action that was taken by my organization at that time, obviously, it raised a lot of questions. And so many people were talking, like even black women said, okay, if this was a black woman, could the organization had hired a chopper, you know, his doctor to go and pick this person from there? Could the organization had given her 3 months break with full pay? Yeah. And could the organization have provided her a provisions to come back or to get to be reassigned in another position? So these are privileges that as black women, I think we do not have.
Another thing they may not have is equal compensation. Many black African aid workers don't get the pay their white colleagues receive, nor the same perks like accommodation allowances and maybe access to vehicles on weekends. A 2009 study by the University of New Zealand found that pay disparities in the aid sector created among local staff, quote, significant feelings of workplace injustice. They felt less valued than their expatriate colleagues. Linda tells me that even though she's been harassed on the job many times, she's never filed a complaint. She doesn't see the point.
There wouldn't be sufficient action taken. And if action is taken, either they will say there's no facts or evidence to substantiate the claim. And then there you are, you know. Because I have seen it happen. I have seen it happen to many staff. There was one when I was a national staff. The thing was investigated. The lady became an outcast in the organization. And yes, I've not really gone steps to report because basically you don't expect anything to be done about it.
Back in the studio with Amy Costello, I mean, that is pretty damning, Amy, coming from somebody who works in the sector. What have aid organizations themselves said about these allegations of different treatment for national staff and for international staff?
Well, you know, it needs to be said that people who start off as national staff certainly can and do kind of work their way up the ladder and get, you know, nice pay and perks. But proponents of this kind of dual pay system will argue that international staff have higher costs of living, you know, back home, and that aid groups need to offer them competitive salaries. And they also want to avoid, you know, skewing the pay scales of local economies when lots of aid groups come in and flood a crisis zone and they pay the locals what they're paying, say, international staff. That could really adversely impact local organizations who are simply trying to pay local staff a going rate. But it's this general sense of unequal treatment on the part of national staff that may impact the sense of agency that they feel and whether they're going to report sexual abuse when it happens. And my producer, Freddie Boswell, and I, we wanted to hear from more national staff about their experiences with sexual assault and harassment. And we had a very hard time finding anyone who would speak to us.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think right now there is a certain level of frustration among aid workers about the pace of change in the sector as it relates to abuse and harassment. And we'll discuss some of that tomorrow. But one aid worker I talked to who has shared her story in the media about her assault at the hands of a colleague, she told me that she really has been struggling lately since going public. She feels nothing has really changed since she told her story. She then received an email from her employer after her case was profiled in the media, which brought back a lot of flood of emotions for her. So there can be a high cost for going public. And another reason we may not hear from local aid workers about sexual abuse is because they have so much riding on these jobs. You know, they're highly prized in these countries. Mm-hmm. They are often supporting extended family with their jobs, so they have so much to lose. But there was another worker we did find. Her name is Leslie Agams, and she said she would speak to me. She's a Nigerian and says national staff suffer from a lot of abuse.
Women in Africa who are working for international development, they need a whole lot more protection. The stories I heard before I became a victim, some of them were horrendous.
Agams used to work for a well-known international aid group in Nigeria, and she says she was sexually assaulted by her boss, but the organization could not find sufficient evidence to substantiate her claim. So we're not going to get into the particulars of her case, but we wanted to get Agams' take on sexual harassment and abuse in the sector more broadly. And she and Linda, who we heard from earlier, both agree that many aid workers face it regardless of race or where they're from.
There was at least one victim who was an American. She was an intern, and she was brutally, from what I heard, raped by an American expatriate. They were in Congo. Her abuser took advantage of the fact that they were in Africa, where the laws and the rules are more, what word would I use?
Less enforceable.
Yes, exactly. You know, the judicial system is more vulnerable to influences, especially the influence of money. And they do things that they would not dare try in Europe or in the U.S.
So, Amy, quick question. Do these cases fall into some sort of legal limbo because you've got foreign organizations based in the U.S. or the U.K., different sets of laws from the countries these aid workers are assigned to? How does that all work out?
Yeah, it's all incredibly complicated. And this seems to be another reason why many aid workers who are victims of sexual assault don't report. We spoke to Christine Williamson. She's the founder and director of Duty of Care International, and she helps aid groups put policies and systems in place so that workers are safe in humanitarian settings. And she says when victims want to report assault that happens in the midst of a humanitarian crisis or in a conflict zone, there's basically one way to do it.
I think it'll depend on who and where and when. But on the whole, I would say it depends on the law of the land, whether or not you report this to the police. I would say 9 times out of 10, you're supposed to report it to the police.
And I can imagine, though, I mean, anybody would likely imagine how difficult and perhaps even improbable that would be, you know, in a conflict zone or with a, you know, corrupt government, or there's rebel forces around, or who knows what, a food crisis, a famine. I mean, the idea that somebody would actually go to local police to report this just seems unlikely to me.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, they probably won't want to. In fact, the last thing they'd probably want to do is report it to the local police, where the justice system isn't known or trusted, where there may be a culture of stigmatization. The whole thought of reliving a traumatic act in a foreign environment, maybe even in a different language. I would imagine it's just the last thing that anyone would want to do. And I have known cases where it hasn't been reported for that reason.
So, Amy, tell us what aid organizations can do to support victims of sexual abuse and harassment and protect their staff before something actually happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things in order to make women and men feel safe doing this work is to have processes in place that employees trust and that they know what will happen if they do report, that they will be taken care of and provided for by their organization, that they will not be singled out. And those are some of the things that we'll hear about tomorrow. And here's Heidi Lehman, an aid worker, talking about what she would like to see happen.
From an aid worker being raped in South Sudan to sexual harassment happening in Haiti, I want to see senior management go through scenario-based training so they know what to do.
Tomorrow, Amy Costello will be bringing us more voices from the international aid community when our series wraps up. It's in partnership with Nonprofit Quarterly. And speaking of tomorrow, be sure to join us for a Facebook Live at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Amy will be hosting a panel on the Me Too movement in the aid sector. You'll find that at our Across Women's Lives Facebook page. Or if you're in the Boston area, you can check it out in person.
That's at 4 p.m. at the Boston Public Library. Just enough time before the break to preview a conversation you'll hear tomorrow on The World. Wendell Stevenson is a reporter who spent years based in the Middle East. After the 2015 terrorist attacks in Paris, which by then was Stevenson's home, she began thinking about what it means when the violence of war comes to your doorstep.
And when this kind of violence erupts and it's sudden and shocking and out of nowhere and seems to target innocent people running a marathon, sitting outside, having a drink with friends on a Friday night, it really feels like, you know, you're under attack for just the way you're living your life and going around about your business. And it's very disquieting. It's very unnerving.
Stevenson decided to turn to fiction to capture feelings that might be too raw for journalism. She tells us about making fiction out of some very raw, very real feelings. Her main character, a journalist like her, ends up losing her cool.
And so I wanted it to creep up on the reader, to be a plausible transition, so that there's a kind of moment where she really gets angry and has a huge confrontation with an Arab guy. And I wanted that to be shocking, that the reader at that point to be like, oh my God, did that just come out of her mouth? That's really unpleasant.
We also get into the bigger issue of feeling anxious about shooters, bombers, and the violence we see in the media.
I think the more you're exposed to it, and I think we can see it in Europe now, it's not that familiarity breeds contempt, but it becomes less shocking.
She says the lesson from Europe about anxiety,
it recedes a little bit in the sharpness.
Journalist and author Wendell Stevenson. We talk about her new novel, Paris Metro. That's on the show tomorrow. Is the African continent in danger of splitting apart? The short answer is no, at least not in the next few million years. But people living in Kenya's Rift Valley aren't so sure about that. Following heavy rains, a giant crack has opened up in the earth there. And I mean giant. My BBC colleague Ferdinand Omondi has the story.
I have come to the Suswa area of southwestern Kenya, which has been in the headlines for several days. A massive crack split open the earth, stretching for over several kilometers, and the biggest impact was on one of the highways, which was completely submerged at a section and made it impossible for vehicles to cross. Now that road has been repaired and motorists can now pass through. But this is an event that happened twice. It cracked open last week, they repaired it, and then it cracked again. And now, in as much as vehicles are now moving back and forth, there have been concerns about the safety of motorists and even the people living here in light of the heavy rains that have been pounding this section. And government officials have come here to give their reassurances.
We have put people to be on watch out, and we have put safety measures that any time the road is, they see anything developing, and it usually takes a few minutes, they close the road.
Now, these cracks stretch for several kilometers on either side of the highway, and some parts are really scary. I can see one section that is wider than 20 meters, and I've also spotted some parts which may not be so wide, but they are so deep that you cannot see the bottom with your naked eye. Now, I have decided to follow this massive crack as it goes further inland from the main highway. And what I notice is that the width and depth shrinks, but you can still spot it quite clearly, cutting through farms that people have already tilled and into one homestead where I am right now. It belongs to 77-year-old Eliud Njoroge. And I can see that the crack has cut right through his garden and it's passing right in front of his house. It's a house he lived in for 20 years and he has decided to bring it down. He demolished it 2 days ago, I'm told. I just want to find out what is running through his mind. I had to demolish my house. The crack reached the house. There's a risk that the house will be swallowed and all my property destroyed. Now we don't have anywhere to stay. We are being housed by our neighbor.
Eliud Njoroge in Kenya's Rift Valley, ending that report by the BBC's Ferdinand Omondi. Finally today, the world's Brandy Fulwood takes us on a musical journey. Here's her latest A-side, B-side.
Listening to Safarini, this album from the Smithsonian Archives, I thought a lot about songs that capture what it sounds like to travel. Safarini means in transit or on a journey. So when I listened to the self-titled track, that sound of travel started to come together as cruising through water, striking rocky ground, tumbling through grass, or, okay, if you're sitting by the wing of a plane and you're about to take off and the wheels just keep moving faster and faster, and for some reason you're holding your breath, and just before it lifts, there's this humming. It's muffled, and it's kind of like... The entire album is like that. This song is performed by Frank Owenya and Afrosound with Yoko Nzenze. It's not a one-time travel, but the places these musicians have come from and gone to. That's why you'll hear subtle references to Seattle or Kenya. Each song on the album conjures the sound of journey. The percussion trudges along this brightness that taps back and forth. He says, take your time, stay cool. And yet there's this woven relationship between warmness and brightness that grazes over this heart-racing rhythm. It's not anxiety, but it's that landing feeling. The B-side fully takes on the idea of landing and basking in that fresh, out-of-the-airport vibe. Great Dane by Cosmo Pike is like the sultry cousin to Safarini. Beside the Great Dane, astray in the south, obsessed by your mouth. It takes those surf rock elements but marries them to jazz. Instead of brushing against the waves and amplifying that beach sun, Great Dane kind of takes on this appeal to a post-beach day. Where the sun is coming down, there's a lingering lime taste, and the sand is still warm, but it's been dampened. The drums and guitars sink into the song as if they were these heavy, warm limbs dipping under the toasty ground. The brightness is still there, but in Great Dane it washes over and drifts amongst the snare. Similar to the A-side, it envelops this idea of travel, beyond the obvious instrument and genre references. These two songs sound as though they are traveling on their own sound beds. Travel sounds can be somewhat passive. We don't bring back as many sounds from our trips as we do, say, pictures or t-shirts. When you travel around, whether it's by plane or train, car, foot, boat, bike, whatever, before you put on your headphones, what sounds do you hear as you go along these rides? I asked the world staff, and then I asked them, what do those sound like?
So there's a whole lot of like of me like dragging my suitcase on gravel.
Bong, bong, bong.
And you're next stop Santa Clara, next stop Palo Alto, next stop I can't remember the name of the town.
Mind the gap. Mind the gap.
Please stand clear of the closing doors.
You can't do it with one voice because it's the sound of hundreds of voices. So there's these high ones, blah, 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 blah. And then there are lower ones, blah, 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 blah. And since I didn't speak the language, it was just this marvelous wash of sounds. You've been away
for the fall. For the world, I'm Brandy Fullwood. Impressions over you, blue like bikini eyes, all shallow pain, but it's not deep down. Cigarettes while you're asleep. Nope, I still can't remember the name of that town after Palo Alto. Anyway, Brandy's story is part of Future Folk, a collaboration between the world and Smithsonian Folkways. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow. If you try to ask me why, the fact that I've lied
and you're tired of dying. PRI, Public Radio International.